As we get older, we find ourselves losing family and friends. Last Wednesday, I lost a dear friend, and it's hard to put it behind me. George Beasley and I were friends for 57 years. He was at our wedding back in 1965. Over the years, George and his wife, Ann, traveled with my Ann and I all over the world and to every state of the Union. Our footprints were left in over 75 foreign countries, from the Great Wall of China to Vietnam, Cuba, and Russia. Those adventures brought us close together. George was born poor in Ararat, Virginia, and lost his father in a fire when he was just 7 years old. He served in the Army and worked his way through college. From there, George went into education and became a school principal in Meadow, North Carolina. It was there that he scraped together a loan to put his first radio station on the air, WPYB in Benson. That's where we met. I worked for several of George's stations and became vice president of his company before striking out on my own to own my own stations. George was a self-made multimillionaire. He came to be the largest independent owner of radio stations in the country. What were the odds? We were not just friends. We loved one another like family. His death was the hardest blow I've taken since my mother and father passed away. George was a devoted family man with his wife, Ann, and 5 children, 4 boys and a girl. He was a fine Christian gentleman and loyal friend. I will deliver a eulogy at his funeral in Naples, Florida, on Sunday, and that will be the hardest job I've taken on. He will be buried a few days later in Mount Airy, North Carolina, beside his mother, Mary. We all think that we have longer on this earth than we do. We're reminded to enjoy each day as it comes, because we never know if we'll see another day. But still, we think we'll be here longer. Because of the pandemic, we had not seen each other for more than a year. But 8 weeks ago, something urged me to fly to Naples and visit with my old friend. I think that was the hand of God, and I am so thankful that I got to visit with him one last time. He was weak, but there was no inkling that he only had a couple of months to live. Cherish your family and friends. We are all here by the grace of God, and it is He who will determine when to call us home. George Beasley has been called home, and I will miss him every day for the rest of my life. My commentary today on mass shootings shortly. But first, cyber attacks are now so common. Recent reports show that hackers attack a computer in the United States every 39 seconds. Once an attack happens, millions of people can be harmed. The recent cyber attack on our East Coast oil pipeline shows just what can happen. We still struggle, even today, with gas costs from $3 a gallon to more than $5 a gallon in California. State-run organizations can be shut down, and services can't be provided for civilians. A case in point, the city of Atlanta was attacked using the infamous SamSam ransomware. The attackers asked for a ransom of $51,000. The SamSam ransomware was so harmful to the city of Atlanta that it was offline for 5 full days, and this caused several significant citywide operations to be halted. It ended up having a recovery cost of $17 million. Businesses face over 4,000 hacks every single day using ransomware alone. Cyber attacks can happen on a global scale as well, with hackers breaching government organizations. The National Cybersecurity Center, or NCSC, warns businesses and citizens that Russia is exploiting network infrastructure devices, such as routers, around the world. Their aim is to lay the groundwork for future attacks on critical infrastructure, such as power stations and energy grids. It is such a threat that nuclear plants can be attacked, causing a nuclear disaster with millions of lives lost. In Iran, one of the nuclear facilities was attacked by a malicious computer worm called Tuxnet that ruined one-fifth of Iran's nuclear centrifuges. These cyber worms caused centrifuges to heat up and could have caused an explosion, costing human lives. Given the evil coming from Iran, it's easy to say that, well, they had it coming. But if it can be done to Iran, it can be done to the United States. The fast changes in technology will cause a boom in cyber attacks with the advent of the 5G network. According to the Brookings Institute, 5G networks create a greatly expanded, multidimensional cyber attack vulnerability. It is this redefined nature of networks, a new network ecosystem of ecosystems, that requires a similar redefined cyber strategy. Further, they stated that the increase in cyber vulnerabilities of software makes it difficult to retool how organizations would secure the most important network of the 21st century. The advent of modern technologies is exponentially increasing the number of connected devices to the extent that there were around 200 billion connected devices at the end of 2020. Cyber warriors are increasing their knowledge, while hackers can now utilize artificial intelligence and machine learning to trigger automated cyber attacks that can easily compromise secure systems without any human intervention. These automated cyber attacks pose a global scare and can be done on a mass volume. There has been an influx of hacks and breaches of brand name companies in recent years. It's causing millions of dollars in damages to recover their data and penalties through fines. All these expenses will cause not only C-level executives to lose their jobs, but associates can lose their position due to the company's cutting cost. Not only do nations and businesses face threats from the actions and intentions of hackers, but individuals face many risks as well. Identity theft is a huge issue, where hackers steal an individual's personal information and sell it for a profit. This also puts the personal safety of an individual and his or her family at risk. This has happened on numerous occasions, and millions of dollars have been lost at the expense of the victim. In other cases, the hackers use blackmail and extortion after stealing your identity and demand ransom money to take no further action against you. As companies, large and small, scramble to respond to the growing threats, jobs in the cybersecurity field are growing fast. Companies are willing to pay up to six figures for an experienced cyber warrior. The typical information security analyst makes $98,350 a year, or $47.28 per hour. States like Virginia provide scholarships where there is a need to hire more IT professionals. It is time for our government to take this problem more seriously. It's also time to hold other countries who either commit or allow others to commit these attacks within their country accountable. Stronger penalties against these cyber attackers and hackers, including the death penalty, should be examined. I don't begin to pretend that I know enough about computers, cyber attacks, hackers. I just know what I read and what my research is telling me about the threat to us in the future. And now, to my commentary on mass shootings and gun control. It's out of control again, and the naysayers are out screaming for guns to be taken away from the American people. We allow that at our own peril. I share credit today with Walter Williams and Dennis Prager for their research and input, which I combine with my own. It's happened again. A gunman opened fire at a light rail yard in Santa Clara, California, on May 26, killing 9 people. The shooter was identified as Samuel Cassidy, a 57-year-old divorced white man who worked at the facility. He set his house on fire that morning before leaving with murder on his mind. The shooting joins an onslaught of gun violence in the United States. In March, 8 people were killed by a gunman at 3 spas in Atlanta and a nearby county. 6 days later, 10 people were killed at a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado. Weeks later, 8 people were killed when a gunman fired on workers at a FedEx facility in Indianapolis. Predictably, the calls went out for more gun control. Before we discuss violence with guns, I'd like to run a couple of questions by you. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, every day nearly 30 Americans die in motor vehicle crashes that involve drunk driving. What kind of restrictions should we place on automobile ownership? Should there be a federal background check in order for people to obtain a driver's license or to purchase a car? The FBI's Uniform Crime Report shows that nearly 3 times more people are stabbed or hacked to death than were killed with shotguns and rifles combined. The number of shotgun or rifle deaths totaled 548. People who were stabbed or hacked to death totaled 1,573. Should there be a federal background check and waiting period for knife and machete purchases? And by the way, if we're going to hold gun manufacturers responsible for shooting deaths, should we not hold liquor stores responsible for deaths by drunk drivers? That makes as much sense as holding gun manufacturers responsible for what people do with guns. Any mature and responsible person would argue that it is utter nonsense to deal with drunk driving deaths and knife deaths by having federal background checks and waiting periods to obtain a driver's license or to purchase a car or a knife. One would recognize, just as courts and the general public do, that cars and knives are inanimate objects and cannot act on their own. Therefore, if we want to do something about deaths resulting from drunk driving or being stabbed or hacked to death, we must put the focus on individuals. It would be folly and gross negligence of victims for us to focus on inanimate objects like cars and knives. Guns are also inanimate objects, and like cars and knives, cannot act on their own. It's also plain folly to focus on guns in cases of shooting deaths. What about the availability of guns? It turns out that for most of our history, a person could walk into a hardware and department store or a gun store virtually anywhere in the United States and purchase a rifle or pistol. The 1902 Sears mail order catalog had 35 pages of firearms advertisements. Other catalogs from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s were full of gun advertisements directed to both youngsters and parents. Just a very few states even had age restrictions for buying guns. Private transfer of guns to juveniles were unrestricted. Often a 12th or 14th birthday present from a father to his son was a shiny new 22 caliber rifle. Today, there is far less availability of shotguns, rifles, and pistols than at any other time in our history. That historical fact should raise the question, despite the greater accessibility to guns in previous decades, why wasn't there the kind of violence we see with today's far more restricted access to guns? Have rifles and pistols changed their behavior from yesteryear and are now out committing mayhem and evil? To answer that in the affirmative can be dismissed as pure lunacy. Thus, if guns haven't changed, then it must be that people have changed. Half-witted psychobabble such as stopping children from playing schoolyard games like cops and robbers and cowboys and Indians doesn't do very much. Calling for more gun restrictions, gun-free zones, and other measures have been for naught. In fact, our major cities with the strictest gun control laws have the most incidents of gun violence. We must own up to the fact that laws and regulations alone cannot produce a civilized society. Morality is society's first line of defense against uncivilized behavior. Moral standards of conduct have been under siege in our country for over half a century. Moral absolutes have been abandoned as guiding principles. We've been taught not to be judgmental, that one lifestyle or set of values is just as good as any other. We no longer hold people accountable for their behavior, and we accept excuse-making. Problems of murder, mayhem, and other forms of antisocial behavior will continue until we regain our moral footing. Try this question to any one of those 50 million-plus Americans who are 65 or older. Do you recall any discussions about the need to hire armed guards to protect students and teachers against school shootings? Do you remember school policemen patrolling the hallways? How many students were shot to death during the time that you were in school? For me and other Americans 65 and older, when we were in school, a conversation about hiring armed guards and having police patrol hallways would have been seen as lunacy. There was no reason for it. So what's the difference between yesteryear and today? The job for those of us 65 or older is to relay the fact that guns were more available and less controlled in years past, when there was much less mayhem. I grew up in a household where a gun was always available. I was taught how to use a gun and how to keep me and those around me safe when I was touching a gun. By age 10, I was hunting squirrels and rabbits with my grandfather's 16-gauge shotgun, not for sport, but to help put meat on the family table. That gun never harmed another human being. In the 68 years since then, there have been weapons in my home for protection. Not once have those guns harmed anyone. Something else is the problem. Guns haven't changed. People have changed. Behavior that is accepted from today's young people was not accepted in my generation. There's another aspect to our response to mayhem. When a murderer uses a bomb, a truck, or a car to kill people, we don't blame the bomb or the car or the truck. We don't call for control over those instruments of death. We seem to fully recognize that such objects are inanimate and incapable of acting on their own. We blame the perpetrator. However, when the murder is done using a gun, many do call for control over that inanimate object, the instrument of death, the gun. It is easy to smell a hidden anti-gun agenda. Too many guns? Not enough mental health funding? A mass of violent entertainment? Not so much. More than anything else, the mainstream media itself is at fault for these instances of mass carnage. Every time that a mass shooting takes place in America, things get decidedly more political for a while. On the one end of the spectrum, liberals start decrying gun laws as the catalyst for U.S. mass homicides, while conservatives point their fingers at violent movies and video games. And both sides turn to that glorious excuse above all other excuses. It's obvious mental health related. Let's examine then the things that don't result in mass shootings. Guns are components in all mass shootings in America. And there's no denying that high-powered AR-15s likely make it easier for mass killers to quickly make a whole lot more dead bodies. But looking at overall U.S. homicide statistics on average, more people are killed by intentional blunt trauma than by so-called assault rifles, and a growing number of mass shooting incidents since Sandy Hook, including the 6 corpse pileup created by an incensed virgin, Elliot Roger, have been perpetrated by assailants using more mundane handguns and rifles. Roger actually stabbed 3 people to death and shot 3 to death, though that got buried in the media reports for some reason. We can argue all day about whether or not the so-called assault weapon sales, moratoriums, or ammunition size limits would prevent mass deaths. But the reality is that so many firearms are already out there that a new assault weapons ban would not help anyway. If you counted up all the people who have been killed in mass shootings over the last 30 years, the cumulative body count would equal less than 0.1% of the total number of murder victims in the United States over the same time frame. The same way, only a microscopic percentage of the 30 to 40% of Americans who own guns commit mass homicide. A similarly teensy, itsy-bitsy percentage of Americans with mental health illnesses embark upon mass shooting sprees. Approximately a fifth of all U.S. adults have some sort of mental health diagnosis. And the percentage of Americans under the age of 18 with mental health diagnosis is certainly even greater. At least 20% of U.S. inhabitants have some sort of psychiatric issue. But 20% of the United States is not running around gunning mass hordes of other people down, either. Movies such as Natural Born Killers and violent video games such as Postal are frequently cited as catalysts for mass murder. But less than 10,000 Americans intentionally pick up a gun, intentionally target another human being, and intentionally murder another human being each year in America. The number of individuals who actually embark upon mass shootings makes up an almost negligible portion of the total viewer and gaming audience. If the meltdown of the nuclear family had any sort of obvious correlation to mass shootings, it seems as if minorities would make up the large percentage of U.S. mass shooters. However, the typical U.S. spree shooter remains a white male who, more often than not, grew up in not only a two-parent household, but a relatively, if not considerably, wealthy one. So with all our tried and true scapegoats put out to pasture, what causes mass violence? We can, of course, start with blaming the shooters themselves. These are folks who grew to utterly hate themselves as people. And then they blamed those around them for their own self-loathing. Ever the egotistical and paranoid sort, the aspiring mass shooter then finds personal empowerment through an indiscriminate hatred of all humanity. Everyone is responsible for their failures except them. With their universally directed resentment taking over their lives, they decide to withdraw socially, becoming more invested in their own vengeance-filled thoughts. Nobody thinks I'm important, and the world as a whole will never accept how great I think I am. They soon fall into a deep depression, with mass homicide, more often than not, coupled with their own suicide, serving as their idealized liberation from existential insignificance. The formula could not get any clearer here. Hate plus isolation plus hopelessness equals mass homicide thoughts. However, there's still a major component lacking, that being a decisive trigger that goads the individual from just thinking about killing a whole bunch of innocent people to actually planning to go out and kill a whole bunch of innocent people. And this is where the media comes in. If you kill yourself, you're just another forgotten footnote. But if you go out and kill a whole bunch of other people, though, you just might become a celebrity. In today's 24/7 cable news ecosphere, those murderous individuals know that if they kill enough people, they will never have to live in anonymity ever again. The importance that the media bestows upon mass killers, even after their death, is why these mass shootings take place. An entire culture of death has arisen from the media complex's morbid, sensationalistic celebration of mass murder and mass killers. The more you kill, the more the media will talk about you, the killer. You were a nobody. And suddenly, through one act of violence, you are in everybody's living room. You're famous. Those police sirens and terrified screams might as well be the sounds of cha-chinging cash registers to America's journalistic titans. What's tragic to the rest of society is their business opportunity. And as long as bullet-riddled children and gory crime scenes prove lucrative, such needless blood-spilling will remain a permanent element of the American experience. I thank you for listening today. I'll be back again next weekend, God willing. Same time, same station. And God bless America.